So this is session number 6 of what I've titled this whole series, Revelation Road Trip. And so this is session number 6. We're going to be talking about, well, we're in the middle of the seven churches, and this week, today, it's going to be the letter to the church at Smyrna. So this is the second church, and it's found in Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. And before we get into that, just a quick review. There are, as we've noted previously, there are seven acts, seven scenes in the book of Revelation, following sort of a Greek drama format. And the letter to the seven churches is the first of those acts. So that act is a single unit. Began with an introduction that introduced the setting for the letters, and now we are into the details of the seven churches, the acts themselves. Each of the letters follows a similar format. Begins with the addressee, or who is writing, or who is dictating the letter. Follows with a command to John to write down what is being said. The speaker identifies himself, and in this identification, he uses terms, phrases that have been found in the introduction section of the act, the revelation in Revelation chapter 1, the second half. Each of the letters acknowledges the current situation at each church, and nearly all of them begin with the phrase, "I know your works," and then describes what is going on. That is followed by an exhortation of some kind. There is then a warning or a promise in each of the letters, and usually both, followed by a challenge to hear, and then a promise to him who conquers. Although each letter is addressed to a specific church, because the book of Revelation is a circular letter, it's going to go through to all these churches, it's meant to be read and heeded. Each of the letters is meant to be read and heeded by every one of the churches. We discuss that this act, these seven letters, appears to follow a chiastic structure. And a chiastic structure is when there's correspondence and parallels between, key is the Greek X letter, but you can think of it as a V, where the first and seventh churches have parallels, the second and sixth churches have parallels, the third and fifth churches have parallels, and the middle church is the fourth church.
Is the emphasis on the middle? Kind of the climax?
Yeah, the middle, in the chiastic structure, the main point or the turning point, the climax, usually is in that middle section. The letters to the seven churches have traditionally been kind of understood as sequential, where you begin with the first church and things progress until the very last church, the seventh church. And that, traditionally, the letters to the seventh church in Laodicea has been considered the main point of the seven letters. However, I would like to explore this alternate scenario in which the middle church has, maybe has the main point for these series. What's interesting is that this middle letter is the longest of all seven. This church appears to be divided. It has both good and bad in abundance. So with that, today we're going to be looking at the second letter, the letter to Smyrna. And Smyrna, the letter to Smyrna mentions no problems. Similarly, the corresponding sixth church, Philadelphia, also, there's no problems mentioned in the letter to that church. So Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. This is the shortest of the letters. Begins, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death." So, once again, I want to begin with the impressions that that form in your mind, images, as you listen to what is being said to this church, the church in Smyrna.
He's talking to a group of people that have been through trials, and sounds like they've been betrayed in some way.
Okay. So perhaps some kind of, well, obviously problems, maybe some kind of betrayal.
Implying that there's more problems, even probably, possibly worse problems coming.
Okay.
But they're temporary. And there's a reward at the end.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. First of all, it's very short. Mm-hmm. There's no criticism of the church. Mm-hmm. There are no warnings given. Perhaps they are experiencing active persecution. It's hard to tell. We tend to associate the word tribulation with persecution, and that may or may not be true. However, it does appear that more severe tribulations, more severe persecution are going to follow shortly. Now, what is this synagogue of Satan? Now, that's a very strong term. Notice that the phrase, "do not fear," appears. And if you take a look back at chapter 1 of Revelation, verses 17 and 18, it read, "Fear not. I am the first and the last who died and now is alive." You notice that in verse 8, it began, "the words of the first and last who died and came to life." Well, that and "fear not" go together, so there's just that correspondence there going back to that introduction section in chapter 1. There is the idea of testing, that you may be tested. This is in verse 10. And that seems perhaps like an allusion back to verse 15 of chapter 1 about Son of Man was described as having a feet of bronze, feet like bronze, refined in a furnace. And what about the 10 days? It seems like a pretty short period. It's not very long. Perhaps the impression is that here is that some in this church will lose their lives, or be faithful unto death. Again, it doesn't seem to this problem is not something that is going to last forever, though perhaps in the midst of it, when people are experiencing it, it may feel like it's lasting forever. And the promise is that is going to be life for all who remain faithful. The second letter is to Smyrna, the city of Smyrna, the church in Smyrna. The first one was to the church in the city of Ephesus. Smyrna is about 35 miles north of Ephesus. Of the seven cities that Revelation is addressed to, Smyrna and Philadelphia, if you recall, Philadelphia is the corresponding church in the chiastic structure, yeah, the sixth, held out the longest against Turkish conquest. And these two are the two where the letters contain no rebuke. Smyrna, like Ephesus, was one of the oldest centers of the imperial cult, but it never achieved the honor of Ephesus. Smyrna was famous for its wealth, for its fine buildings, and its devotion to science and medicine. So although perhaps not as renowned and great as Ephesus, it was certainly not a backwater city. It was a well-educated, wealthy, cosmopolitan city. It was, like Ephesus, a harbor city. It was known for its beauty. It had paved streets, a library, gymnasium, a shrine to Homer. Who's Homer?
Iliad, the Odyssey.
Yeah, that's one of the great literary greats of ancient Greek. And it also contained a temple to the Mother Goddess. It appears that Christians in both Smyrna and Philadelphia experienced, again, not definitively, but probably, expulsion from Jewish synagogues. Smyrna did have a strong Jewish community. Now, again, Christians saw themselves as the true descendants of Judaism, the next step in Judaism. Obviously, the rest of the Jews did not see things that way. And when their practices and when their beliefs began to differ, and when they didn't want Christians in their midst anymore. It is known that the Jews did expel Christians from attending their synagogues. So Christians were no longer welcome within the Jewish circle. And so the Christians were thrown out. So in denying that, this is from the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary in the New Testament on this passage. It reads, in denying that John's opponents are spiritually Jewish, he seems to return the charge they have made against Christians. In calling the Jews, a synagogue of Satan, his rhetoric resembles that of the Dead Sea Scrolls, where a persecuted Jewish sect that considered the rest of Judaism apostate called its opponents the lot of Belial, or Satan. John appears to be using familiar language to call the opponents of Christians the synagogue of Satan.
Familiar name calling.
Continuing, people were betrayed to provincial officials by dilatores, or informers. So, it wasn't that there was a official systematic persecution of Christians, but if Christians were accused of something like, what's the word? When you go against
troublemaking,
rioting, when you are
treason.
Yeah, treason. Mm-hmm. When any particular Christian was accused of that sort of thing, treason or just making trouble, then the officials would be obliged to investigate. Mm-hmm. And by the early 2nd century, it is attested that Christians in Asia Minor were generally charged only if accused by such informers. By the early 2nd century, Jews in Smyrna were reportedly fulfilling this function against Christians, such as Polycarp, one of the important Christian figures in the 2nd century, the late 1st and early 2nd centuries. But simply claiming publicly that Christians were no longer welcome as part of the synagogue community was a form of betrayal. Christians who were not seen as Jewish had no protection against civil requirements for participation in the emperor cult. The Jews were grandfathered in as one of the ancient religions of the Roman Empire. So Jews were afforded a certain degree of freedom and latitude in their
worship,
yeah. In their monotheistic worship.
That might be more of the treason thing that they were getting in trouble for as Christians, were the not being faithful to the...
Right. As long as Christians could claim that they were Jews,
they
were able to say that...
They were a recognized religion.
They were a recognized religion. But when they are thrown out of the synagogue and Jews disclaim...
When the Jews say no, they're not part of us.
Then the Christians have no further excuse.
Now they're getting thrown in jail for being like the rest of the citizens of Rome that aren't paying attention to their...
Right.
Okay.
So many Christians were martyred in Smyrna over the next several centuries. Jewish martyr stories praise those who were faithful to death and thus would be resurrected at the end. Mm-hmm. Crowns were victors' rewards for athletes or military heroes. A number of ancient writers also mentioned the crown of Smyrna, possibly referring to the city's beauty. So once again, John is writing in terms of phrases and imagery that is familiar to his audience. So this letter begins with the self-identification of the person speaking, the first and the last who died and came to life. So how does this speak to those who are under tribulation? Now, if Smyrna is under some kind of tribulation, probably not active persecution, but they are facing pressures to conform. Again, the book of Revelation is speaking about accommodation. You know, how much can Christians accommodate the culture surrounding them, yet still remain faithful? And so they're facing this pressure to accommodate to the emperor cult that is all around them. And now, especially with being thrown out of the synagogues, they can no longer claim that they are Jews. The pressure increases. The self-identification is the first and the last who died and came to life. How would that speak to the church in Smyrna?
That they were willing to lay down their moral lives so that the spirit of Christ could continue in the Christian name, so that, you know, people in Smyrna, people in Rome would see that the Christian community is willing to find any way possible to perpetuate their belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're being threatened with death, and the letters being written from the one who died and came to life.
It's a message of hope. Mm-hmm. You know, the first and the last. Jesus is speaking of himself as the beginning and the end, as one who died and has come to life. So here's a couple thoughts that I had. Just as Jesus was at the beginning of their Christian experience, he's going to be with them all the way to the end.
Even though the middle is unpleasant, he's the first and the last. He will be there through everything.
Yeah.
So it's not a metaphor, or it's not a martyrism of their selves at this time, then, so they're not actual people that are going against the emperor and laying down their lives, being thrown in jail to say to the Christian community that, you know, we'll still be alive with our faith in Christ or something like that.
I don't know if they were intentionally going against and going up to be martyred.
I don't think any of them wanted to be martyred at this point in time, although later on, another 50 to 100 years, there were a few Christians recorded that almost went out of their way to get themselves martyred.
But these guys were simply in a situation where they were
they're
no
facing,
longer accepted
right.
by any of the cultural categories.
They're facing pressure to be accepted.
To be acceptable.
To be acceptable, yeah. The second thought that I had in regards to that self-identification is that just as Jesus conquered that death, those who die have hope beyond the grave. Some of pagan philosophy was that life is kind of a circle, that it's never ending. Mm-hmm. Jesus clearly speaks against that history is linear, that there is a beginning and there is an end. Mm-hmm. Another part of, say, Greek mythology regarding death is, you die and your souls end up in some place. Mm-hmm. And there is really no certainty in Greek mythology as to exactly where you're going to end up. It's kind of at the whim of the gods. Where Christians have a very certain promise.
It was also kind of to your taste, too. Maybe didn't necessarily mean that it was a bad place. That was to your taste.
True.
Greek mythology.
Yeah.
If war and debauchery was your thing, then Haiti was not exactly the place where you were, you were accepted into or aspired to get to. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, continuing, the church situation is that it is under tribulation. Tribulation means a time of trouble. And when you say time of trouble, for Christians, for modern-day Christians, that connotation is something that's off in the future.
A very specific event.
Yeah, specific event. But for John and for the audience that he is writing to, this tribulation or time of trouble is not off in the future. It's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's a present situation. Again, tribulation doesn't necessarily mean persecution, but it could simply mean pressure to conform to societal norms. Mm-hmm. And if we take that definition of tribulation, then Christians have faced tribulation all through history. It's not something that is going to happen in the future. It's happening now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's the pressure to conform so that we can be acceptable.
Yeah.
So we can not raise eyebrows. Mm-hmm. The church situation talks about, reads, I know your poverty, but then a parenthetical statement, but you are rich. So materially, the church there, the congregation, the Christians in Smyrna, apparently were not wealthy, mm-hmm. as opposed to the rest of the population, much of the rest of the population.
They were in a wealthy culture.
They were in a wealthy city, but due to their beliefs and practice, Christians in the city apparently were struggling materially. Part of that is because the city guilds, the craft guilds, whatever, your trade, whatever it is, involved
politics,
and politics necessarily involved the emperor and all of the deities. So if Christians do not conform to the emperor cult and to the religious norms,
they have no business.
They have no business unless you happen to be Jewish. Unless you can claim that you are Jews. That Jews, because Jews are exempt. So the Christians in Smyrna, part of their tribulation is that they are struggling in their daily lives. Not just the spiritual pressure to conform, theological pressure to conform, but literal day-to-day living, apparently, they were having difficulty. But John's reminder is that they are spiritually rich. It's a reminder that material wealth is not the most important consideration when evaluating present circumstances. They were also slandered. And perhaps the allusion there is that Jesus too was slandered. So the church in Smyrna can identify and should be identifying with the life of Jesus. Just as Jesus was under pressure and under tribulation through his life, just as Jesus had nothing really to call his own. Mm-hmm. But
Jesus was persecuted by the same group of people. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But Jesus, even though from the world standards, he was poor. Mm-hmm. He had a relationship with God that could not be measured by wealth. And I think that's what this letter is reminding the church in Smyrna. You have a relationship with God that cannot be measured by worldly standards. And people may say bad things about you, but don't worry about it. The exhortation in this letter is to do not fear what you are about to suffer. Be faithful unto death. It's about choice. One of the spiritual freedoms that Jesus grants is to make a choice. And to give in to fear is a choice. To feel fear is not a choice. That happens. But to give in to fear is a choice. To take courage instead is a choice. And the promise that's found just a verse down is life. Yes, people die. You may die a premature death. But physical death in this world is not the end. So, there is no good reason to give in to fear. Because life continues beyond this physical existence here in this world. Then we come to the phrase, the pair of words, 10 days. And this is the only significant Old Testament allusion in this letter, and thus it is probably a key to its interpretation. The allusion is to Daniel chapter 1, verses 12 to 16. I do want to turn to that. So, Daniel, along with a number of Jewish nobles at that point in time, are taken as prisoners to Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar. And these prisoners, these exiles, they're not treated as, they're not abused. In fact, they're treated completely opposite. They're given everything they could possibly want except their, obviously, their freedom to return. Mm-hmm. They're given food and drinks from the king's table. Start with verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. But this chief, this person in charge, is afraid of what might happen. He's afraid that if Daniel does not eat from the king's table, that he would not take the king's drinks, that Daniel would wither away and become unhealthy, and as a result, the person in charge would be concerned for his own life. With that, Daniel says, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables.
10 days is a kind of a metaphor for testing.
Yeah, it's so Smyrna. The letter to Smyrna is bringing in that imagery from Daniel. And Daniel chapter 1 is not about vegetarianism.
Really?
It's about theology. Because part of any sort of meat, flesh food, when an animal is killed, it was always as a part of some kind of religious sacrifice and ritual. Mm-hmm. We see that in the Hebrew laws as well. They're not supposed to simply kill animals for their meat. And when you kill an animal, it's a sacred process. Mm-hmm. It always involves God.
So the question is, which God?
Yeah, the same thing is applicable to all the other cultures and religions of that time, in that area.
Mm-hmm. So whenever you eat meat, the implication is that you are
acknowledging some God for the blessings of providing that meat. So it becomes a matter of accommodation. Which God are you respecting? Which God are you accommodating?
Which God are you trusting for your sustenance?
Correct. So at issue is not one of health. It's not about vegetarianism. It's about theology.
It's about not eating off the king's table just to live and being okay with it because you have to eat. It's basically like saying then just stay as a Christian, because if you stay in this world and you start to eat of this world, then you'll mm-hmm. become like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Daniel's attitude was, who am I going to trust? Who am I going to depend on? Am I going to depend on the king of Babylon, who in turn is receiving this food and the wine from as a blessing of Marduk?
Yeah.
Or am I going to reject that and take what has not been offered to Marduk for his blessing?
Declaring himself as not worshiping their God.
Right, because no, it's.
And so he was saying to the chief of the eunuchs, he was saying to him, feed us the vegetables and watch ourselves and make your decision there, because he was not worried about upsetting the king, he was worried about upsetting Marty.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Because that's what I think that when he says it will upset the Lord, he wasn't saying that he was going to, and Daniel, mm-hmm. He didn't say the king, he said Marduk. So Daniel was basically professing a little bit of faith of Christianity to that person at the same time. Maybe, I don't know.
I always thought that when the chief eunuch said that, oh, they're gonna dry up and blow away if I don't give them this food, that he was talking about the food itself. He was talking about they're not going to have the blessing of the God.
Yeah.
Can they survive in this land without the blessing of our God?
Yeah. It's not a battle of the foods. It's the battle of the gods.
Yeah.
Daniel is saying, I don't need Marduk or Bel's blessings in order to survive.
I don't need your food. I don't need your God.
I believe my God, Yahweh, is strong enough to sustain me, even in a foreign land. Because one of the other beliefs of that time, Jews included, was that gods were territorial, local and territorial.
Gods had their territories. And if a god's territory was taken over by another country, that weakened the god.
Yeah. So by the Babylonians taking the implements out of the temple and putting it in Marduk's and Bel's temples, it was subjugating Yahweh to the Babylonian gods. And
so to say, my God can still take care of me,
Daniel is way outside traditional norms of theology at that time.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, for Daniel, the pressure like the Christian in Smyrna is to conform, to accommodate. Well, there's plenty of excuses to do so.
Well, and Paul didn't have a problem with it. In his own way.
Mm-hmm. For Daniel, no one would know. He could have accommodated and things would have gone well. But to maintain his distinctiveness could lead to difficulties and perhaps even death for challenging the rule of Babylon. Because he wasn't defying just the king, he was defying the gods of Babylon. So that's...
That's where the 10 days comes from.
Yeah. That's the significance of the 10 days. That's the significance.
So John is not saying to the people that are reading his letter that you have a specific amount of days here where you're going to be tested. Your life is mirroring this event here.
Correct.
As the 10 days that Daniel went through trial to show that his God was capable, as is your life a mirror of the 10 days of that trial.
Makes sense. So it doesn't mean when there's 9 days of trial, there's only 1 day left.
No, the 10 has no...
There's no bearing.
There's no numerical significance. There's no literal or symbolic
That's weird.
Correspondence between the 10 days and some literal amount of time.
Right. Basically, as
it's a metaphor, but again, it's a brief period of time.
Yeah.
It's not going to last forever. That's the message.
But neither are you.
For whose benefit was the testing? Is it for God, the ones being tested, or those observing?
Daniel's time?
Was it for the benefit of Daniel for the testing?
No.
Was it for his God? No. God knew what was going to happen. Daniel didn't know what was going to happen, but it didn't matter to him. Mm-hmm. The results didn't matter.
But for the eunuch and the people that were watching, it was pretty traumatic for them to find out that basically after this time period he was okay.
That Daniel's God could still sustain him.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that perhaps is one aspect of why God allows tests and trials. It's not that God needs them. It's not that we need them, but that those who are watching can see something. So this whole thing, again, is an allusion back to the Babylonian exile. Now, about synagogues. Synagogues were formed during and after the Babylonian exile. Prior to that, there were no synagogues. Okay. Everyone went to the temple in Jerusalem. Because mm-hmm. that was the place of worship. Uh-huh. That was the place of religious instruction.
And the Babylonian exile was the exile of the Jews out of Babylon?
Yeah. Yeah, Jews out of Jerusalem.
Okay. So and that's when they went walking in the desert for 40 years or whatever until they got caught by Pharaoh?
No, no. So synagogues were a creation of the Jews during and after the Babylonian exile. They needed a place to maintain their culture, their beliefs. Became a center of religious instruction and practice for the diaspora, the scattering. And it continued into Roman times, and it continues into the present time. You know, there are synagogues all over the world. So, synagogue of Satan. This letter is indicting and pointing out that Judaism as a religious form no longer is legitimate. No longer has legitimacy. Once again,
time has passed.
John's perspective and belief in Revelation is that Christianity is the true inheritor mm-hmm. of Judaism. Mm-hmm. So if Christianity is true Judaism, then Judaism is no longer
false.
Judaism.
False Judaism. Hmm.
Satan also is literally, the literal meaning is adversary. Mm-hmm. So Jews who cluster around the synagogue are an adversary of Christians.
Which was Paul's basic attitude toward it too, though, in a sense. He was saying that, you know, following the Torah is basically stating that God didn't come down here to show himself to us.
Mm-hmm. Making the old rules, defining yourself by the old rules. Can't do that anymore.
The name Satan, or the word Satan, is found in the Old Testament as always opposing God's people. That is the function of Satan, the function mm-hmm. of the adversary. This title, this name, is also found in intertestamental literature. So again, John isn't making a term up. He's employing terms that's term that is already familiar. It's found 26 times in the New Testament as Satan and translated devil 32 times. John is saying that the synagogue of Satan is now in collusion with Babylon and Rome. The synagogue, which originally came out of Babylon as a way to maintain Jewish distinctiveness, to perpetuate, to continue the beliefs of the true God, is now part of Babylon. And Babylon, for John, is symbolic of Rome. So the concept of Israel as God's people, again, one of John's themes in Revelation, is being transferred from those belonging to Judaism to those who now claim Christ. Israel is, again, not about race or nationality in John's mind. It is about theology. Jews, now that's about race. That's about nationality.
Yeah.
Israel is about who you belong to, which God you belong to. There are two promises that are given in this letter. The letter to Ephesus had one promise. The letter to Smyrna, the second one, now has two promises. as I mentioned in last week in the introduction to these letters, each letter to these seven churches is going to increase the number of promises. So the two promises, I will give you the crown of life. Crown is the laurel wreath that were given to athletes and to military victors as a symbol of victory and power. And the second promise is that the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. And we will see that promise fulfilled in chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. So in summary of the letter to Smyrna, the first point is that troubles, when we're in the midst of it, it may feel like it's going to last forever, that it's lasting forever, but they never do.
10 days.
There's a beginning and there's an end. Second point is that Jesus is with us in our trials. He identifies with us in our troubles. Jesus experienced the rejection, the tribulation, the slander, the question of, how am I going to survive? And he depended upon God. So he knows what we go through. Third point is, physical circumstances are not a good indicator of spiritual reality. You might say there is no correlation between our physical circumstances and spiritual reality.
Wasn't that a foreign concept?
It is.
Well?
It is, because as you go through the Gospels, and it seems that the Jews believe that material prosperity was a sign of blessing from God. And conversely, if you're experiencing poverty, sickness, etc.,
you've been cursed.
God is somehow punishing you.
If you're rich, it's because God likes you.
And similarly, if anyone familiar with Greek or Roman theology and the mythology would say the same thing. If the gods favored you, well, you would receive blessing. Mm-hmm. If gods were angry with you, then you'd be cursed. Mm-hmm. So John is saying, well, that's not reality. That's not Christian reality. Fourth point is that courage is a decision. It's a choice that a person can make. And that choice is what leads to victory. It's not any of the other kinds of works that we might do that leads to victory, but the choice to not fear, but to take courage. That is what leads to victory. And finally, just as Jesus conquered death and obtained life, Christians too already have life through Christ. So there's nothing to fear. There's really nothing to fear because we already have life. And that concludes the letter to the church in Smyrna.